A neighborhood school used to be the center of everything. You sent your kids there. You had community meetings there. You went to vote there.
Especially the high schools, right? And now people say, where'd you go to high school? And you're talking about a school that no longer exists. I went to Cooley. Doesn't exist. Murray Wright. Doesn't exist. Chadsey. What? Not there.
Districts around the country have closed an unprecedented number of schools since 2000. But no city closed more schools in that time than Detroit.
It bothered me because, like I said, I thought it was a good school. And that's one of the reasons we moved right here where we did, was because of the school being there.
What would be the best case scenario for you?
For them to put another school there. I think the neighborhood needs a school.
This hour, we are going to look at how school closures affect students and neighborhoods. I'm Jennifer Guerra. That's all coming up on We Live Here, a State of Opportunity documentary on Michigan Radio. First, the news. Once upon a time, you'd turn on the news, and this is what you'd hear.
Planned closings of 54 Chicago schools is sparking protests and outrage across the
country. Some D.C. parents voiced their opinions today about the proposal to close down 20 D.C. schools.
It's just so sad to think that they're all going to be separated.
Philadelphia is closing almost two dozen of its public schools. The move prompted
Chicago, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, New York, Detroit. For a while there, some of America's biggest cities were closing 10, 20, 40 schools at a time. A large part of it had to do with No Child Left Behind. It's the federal education policy that pushed school closure as a means to raise student achievement. The law went into effect in 2002. And every year since then, more than 1,000 schools across the country have gotten the axe. A couple years, it was as high as 2,100 schools a year. The district that closed the most schools during that time period, Detroit. Over the last decade and a half, Detroit has closed 195 traditional public schools, 195 neighborhood schools. Chastity Pratt-Dossie is a reporter with Bridge Magazine. Back when the school closure crisis was ramping up, she was working for the Detroit Free Press. She watched as school after school closed and students were shuffled around in what some described as a city-sized game of musical chairs.
I grew up in Detroit and the school was, you know, a community center. You went there after school for community meetings. Of course, your parents vote there. And, you know, it's especially high schools, right? The high schools are the center of your neighborhood. And now people say, where'd you go to high school? And you're talking about a school that no longer exists. I went to Cooley. Doesn't exist. Murray Wright. Doesn't exist. Chadsey. What? Not there. So it destabilizes the neighborhoods.
This hour, we are going to talk about schools and what happens to a neighborhood after a school closes. I'm Jennifer Guerra. This is We Live Here, a special State of Opportunity documentary. The Littlefield neighborhood on Detroit's west side is pretty quiet. A lot of vacant houses, some boarded up, some completely gutted by scrappers. The Detroit Land Bank Authority owns more property here than people do. Despite that grim picture, people do live here, families with kids, and the majority of them go to this school, Noble Elementary Middle. Noble was built in 1921. We are talking boom time years for Detroit. The city's population was growing like crazy, and schools were popping up all over the city. These are true neighborhood schools, built smack dab in the middle of the neighborhood so kids can easily walk there. Noble was built to hold more than 1,000 kids. There are only about 600 kids there now.
It's friendly, it's like home.
Takira is 13 years old. She and her twin sister both go to Noble. They've been going here since fourth grade. This is my first day at Noble, and the principal, Latoya Webb Harris, lets me just hang out in the hall and talk to students there. I didn't have to search too hard for somebody to interview. The minute these students saw the mic, they just ran over to talk. And they talked a lot about their principal.
The way our principal treats us, like, she's really forgiving. She knows that kids make mistakes, and she forgives you. Ms. Webb-Harris considers all of us her children, and she would love to see us grow up and be what we're supposed to be.
She'd be like, hey, daughter. She just called me daughter, and she'd be calling me that since, like, the first year she came.
About the benefits of having a school in their neighborhood.
First of all, it's easy to get here. Second of all, you know that when you grow up, you can probably come back to your old neighborhood and say, there go to school.
You barely miss school and stuff, and you could just, like, walk home.
And opinions about the school itself.
Helpful and encouraging. I got good friends, and most of the teachers nice, but some of them, I don't know.
When I first came here, it was horrible because they didn't have paint. They barely had stuff and stuff like books. Like when we used to learn, they didn't have like books. We had to share books and all that. Now we can have our own books.
Can I rephrase something for him? When he said the school was horrible, it wasn't horrible. It just needed more work put into it. And now we got that since we have new staff and new teachers here.
How does it make you feel when you walk into the school?
Happy. Happy.
Not too bad, right? But here's the catch. Noble is considered a failing school. Michigan's Department of Education calls the lowest achieving schools in the state priority schools. And Noble has the dubious distinction of making the state's priority list not once, but twice. The nonprofit Excellent Schools Detroit gives out grades to all the schools in the city every year. Noble got an F. Noble's principal, Latoya Webb-Harris, doesn't sugarcoat how poorly the kids are doing on their assessment tests. She tells them, in front of me, at a school-wide assembly. Before I play the tape, a quick note. You're going to hear her talk about blue bars and orange diamonds. She's talking about some graphs she has up on the projector. The blue bars show how well the kids did on a state test, and the orange diamonds are where the kids should have scored. Okay, here's the tape.
We have a visitor in a reporter that you have seen in the school, and she's here now for a reason. Because of our data, because our blue bars are not in the orange diamonds, some people in the state of Michigan think they should close Noble because we're not doing well on our MAP tests or our MSTAT. They don't think that you're coming to school to learn. They don't think the teachers are teaching because our blue bars are not over the orange diamonds. And in January, the state of Michigan, they're going to release a list of schools whose blue bars are not over those orange diamonds. And they may want to close Noble. And if that happens, what school will we go to?
Let's pause right there for a minute. She asks, what school will you go to if Noble closes? Remember, Noble got an F from Excellent Schools Detroit. Six other schools share the same zip code as Noble. One is a DPS school. The other five are charters. Here is how Excellent Schools Detroit graded them. D plus, D, D, D plus, C, D. That is the educational landscape around Noble. Okay, now back to the assembly.
I thought that we liked Noble. Do we like Noble, boys and girls? So we need a thumbs up if yes or a thumbs down if you don't. So therefore, we have to do better on our tests, correct? You have to come to school every day, put your hands down, put your thumbs down. You have to come to school every day ready to learn. You have to come to school and follow the directions and the expectations.
Webb-Harris has been with DPS her entire career. She started out as a special ed teacher and came to Noble 3 years ago. This is her second year as principal here. She was born and raised in Detroit, went to Cass Tech, one of the city's premier high schools. She lives in the suburbs. Her kids go to school in the suburbs. But she's never wanted to work in the suburbs.
It was not a second thought. I was going to Detroit Public Schools. You know, this is where my heart is. It's personal to me. I needed to be with the children of Detroit.
Webb-Harris did not create a failing school, let's be clear. She inherited it. Now she's trying her best to improve it. How much longer she'll have to do that is unclear.
Now we're kind of in limbo, waiting to see. Our scores have increased, but we have nowhere to go but up because we were looking at 0% proficient based on the MSTEP results.
MSTEP is the new state assessment test. It was rolled out 2 years ago. By all accounts, it's much harder than the old test.
And so now we have doubled to 2% and, you know, we're moving, inching up. So,
okay. So, and you're laughing. So you clearly know that those aren't great test scores, right?
No,
I mean, that's
no,
an overstatement.
Not at all. But like I said, if you're already at the bottom, you have no way, you have no other way but to go is up. And that's what we have been going is up, even with our quarterly assessments. Each assessment, we have more and more students meeting their targeted growth. Eventually, those same students will begin meeting their grade level, and we will see some impact.
Noble is considered a chronically failing school. Michigan's governor put more than 100 schools like Noble on notice last year when he yanked the state's school reform office away from the Department of Education, where he has very little control, and put it in a department that he runs, basically saying, hey, failing schools, I've got my eye on you, and now I can do something about it. So when Webb Harris says she's in limbo, waiting to find out what's going to happen in Noble, that is what she's talking about. Even the local block club members are talking about it. I dropped by one of their meetings back in November. Carol Pickens is one of the founders of the Littlefield Community Association. She is leading the meeting, and the person you hear after her is another resident, David Harris. Let's listen in.
So we just do what we've been doing. What we do is we get on the phone, we go downtown, we do what we need to do to give support and love to our local school.
Well,
we need
Noble. Something?
Yes, David.
All the schools that I have, I'm a retired principal. And I've been a principal at two schools in Detroit. I was a teacher for about 17 years. All the schools that I taught at, all the schools that I was the administrator at, have closed. All those neighborhoods where those schools existed are demolished. They have systematically destroyed our neighborhood school, which has in effect really destroyed our communities.
Absolutely.
So I'm just going to let you know, if Noble closes, that will affect our area around here. That's about the stablest thing that we have going right now besides our park with our community.
So we'll talk about that because we have looked at this before. This is not anything that's going to throw us. We have looked at the possibility of Noble closing and what would we do. And if that school becomes empty, then we look at how can we turn it into a multi-use building. But we're not going to have a building sitting in our community empty and decaying because we are developing our community. We have our park.
Ah, the park. I cannot tell you how many people in this area talk about the park. It's huge. I mean, symbolically huge. I went to the park on a crisp, sunny fall day. Carol and Sandra Pickens from the Block Club agreed to meet me there. The park is adjacent to the school, right in the middle of the neighborhood. And like so many public parks around Detroit, this one had fallen on hard times. The playground was all rusted out. There was garbage everywhere. It wasn't safe for kids. But that all changed in 2008, when the Pickens sisters and a couple others decided to bring the park back to life. The very park they used to play on as kids back in the 60s.
It had a little house where you could go in and you would check out your equipment, your basketball and your baseball. And they had, you could play checkers. They had a setup where you could play checkers, sandbox. We were always over here and you had the softball field and we always had gloves and a baseball cap and a ball. Always, always. It was a game would break out at any time.
Carol moved out west in the 80s and didn't come back to Littlefield until 2000. And when she did, she was devastated to see how far her neighborhood had fallen. The city of Detroit had its own crushing problems to deal with at the time, and the sisters knew their little park wasn't going to be anybody's priority at City Hall. But they were adamant. The only way this neighborhood is going to survive and thrive is if there's a good school and a good, safe park for kids to play on. So they got to work. They applied for grants, drew up a site plan, pitched it to the city, and it was approved. They got money from the city and county to help bring their childhood park back to life. The play structure alone cost $50,000. They put in a walking path for seniors, a picnic shelter, and grills for families. Neighbors planted trees, kids from the school helped pick up trash. They wanted people who lived there to feel like they had a stake in the park.
We could have brought in an organization that could beautify the place. We could have done that years ago, but we understand if you don't change the people's heart, it's going to revert back. And so our goal is that it stays generation from generation from generation, so you have to bring the people along with you.
While we're talking, the gym door at the back of the school opens and students start to run out. They use the walking path around the park as a track. One of the boys in the class walks out and is kind of acting up. He's got a phone in his hand and his shoes aren't tied right. Sandra Pickens calls him out.
Tie your shoe up so you won't fall.
And she cares. She really cares. See, she's going to teach him how to tie his shoe. That's what you do. You get involved. You don't just sit back and turn your head. You get involved. And look at how he's showing her. Look at how he's talking to her. Here, sit here.
They move over to the bench.
Well, then I'm going to double tie it for you, okay? That way it won't come loose. Hand me this. All right?
Okay. She starts to tie his shoe.
Get off of that bench. All right, there you go. Catch up with your buddies. See you later. Have a good day.
In its own very sweet and very specific way, it is one of the most neighborhoody moments I have ever seen. For the Pickens sisters, there is no line between the school and the neighborhood. They both need each other. A strong school and a good park are key to their grand plans for revitalization. And the sisters don't even have school-age kids. The way they see it, all the kids in the neighborhood are their kids. To that end, they are in the process of buying one of the vacant houses across from Noble. They want to turn it into a homework house so kids can go there after school for tutoring. That's their plan. They're not waiting for the city or some big philanthropic organization to swoop in and save them. The folks who live here are trying to bring it back on their own. One park at a time, one block club meeting at a time, one fixed up house at a time.
I've spent a lot of money in my house. I redid it. I redid the whole home, new windows, new roof, new garage, new drive. You know, I redid the whole house. It's very comfortable.
David Harris grew up in the neighborhood, right across from the park. And just like the Pickens sisters, he remembers playing there all the time in the 60s. Like he said, he has put a lot of love and care into his house. He says he put that same kind of love and care into all the Detroit public schools he used to work at, too. And he has worked at a lot of Detroit public schools.
So let's do a rundown of the schools that you worked at.
I've worked at Winterhalter, Jamison, and then my last school was Jimerson. And I was at Wilkins, too, on the east side. Okay. Wilkins, yeah.
So let's do a little checklist. So Winterhalter, still open, still around?
No, I believe it's a charter school now.
Jamison.
Jamison is closed.
Jimerson.
Jimerson is closed. I believe it's been bought by a church.
And Wilkins.
It's closed. It's on the east side. It's closed.
So you do not leave a good trail behind you.
Hey, what can I say? I do the best I can.
The school he talks about most fondly is Jamison, where he was principal. He had student artwork up on the walls. He planted a garden there. His teachers once threw a super fun Halloween party in the gym that he still likes to talk about.
My school was like a mecca of hope in that area. And when it closed, it's like Vietnam, after the war. It's just devastating. I don't even think any children live over there anymore. I think all the children have moved. Vacant houses, vacant lots, dilapidated buildings. It's just a real sad situation.
Jamison closed in 2010, along with roughly 30 other schools in the district. There just weren't enough kids there to justify keeping it open, plus the test scores weren't great. So they were shuttled over to Thirkel Elementary. At the time, it was a higher-achieving school. Now, it's one of the worst schools in the state and is slated for possible closure. Bad news for the kids and bad news for the neighborhood they left behind. David Harris is adamant that cannot happen to his neighborhood. So many people have already left. The land bank owns more houses here than anybody else. But they built that park, and that park is everything.
That park, it is a stabilizing force in the neighborhood.
You are, like, lighting up when you talk about this park, and you've got, like, your fist going. I mean, there is passion around this park.
We don't have that. In our city, we don't have that. You do not have that. That's why I live here. Because people are asking me, why are you still living there? You can move anywhere, but I love that area. I love it. I love it.
You're crying.
I've always been for the underdog. And our neighborhood is an underdog. And we're gonna make it work. Yeah. Yeah.
When a school closes, it's not good for the neighborhood. Property values go down, crime often goes up, and families move out. The Detroit Public School District has closed nearly 200 of its schools since 2000. How did we get to this point?
How did we get here? Oh, my. It seems like a really storied and complex circuitous route, but it's actually really very simple.
The answer coming up in 10 minutes. You're listening to We Live Here, a State of Opportunity documentary on Michigan Radio. This is We Live Here, a State of Opportunity documentary about schools and neighborhoods. I'm Jennifer Guerra. Before the break, we spent time in a neighborhood right on the edge. It's trying for a comeback, but so much depends upon whether the school stays open or closes. Now let's visit a neighborhood that is past that point. Most of the DPS schools in the Brightmoor neighborhood are long gone, abandoned, torn down, or replaced by charters. Things are pretty desolate, especially at night. The one bright spot is the Brightmoor Artisans Co-op on Fenkel Street, one of the few remaining public spaces in the neighborhood. Inside, it kind of looks like the set of an Alice in Wonderland movie. Bright yellow walls and black and white checkerboard floor. Nadia Adolphus is 8 years old, and she is here with her friend Morgan.
I'm 8, and I'm about to be 9.
They're here for a weekly book club. Tonight's book is Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
The next morning, Grandpa Joe went on with his story. "You see, Charlie," he said.
For a book about sweets, these girls talk a lot about vegetables.
I plant tomatoes, carrots, potatoes, strawberries, blueberries.
So many people have moved out of Brightmoor that a lot of the neighborhood looks like the country. So gardening is big here. There used to be 6 DPS elementary schools in Brightmoor. Now there is just one, and it's slated for possible closure at the end of the school year. The 2 closest charters aren't doing much better. Morgan goes to a charter school one neighborhood over. Nadia's grandma drives Nadia 15 minutes away to a school outside of Detroit, in Livonia, even though there is a public elementary school right across the street from where she lives. She has a perfect view of it when she jumps up on the couch and looks out her front window. The school is Hubert Elementary.
My mom used to go there when she was little. My aunt, they, my grandma was a teacher there, but the school closed.
Do they ever talk about it?
Not a lot. My grandma lost her diamond ring in there once. It was really shiny. It looked burned in the inside of the school. Yeah, because it was really dark. Because we went through the school into the back where behind the school is, where we buy our kites every year. Because sometimes we would walk through it or we'd go around it.
You mean when the school was closed, you could still get into the school?
Because there wasn't cardboard over the door.
So you just were able to walk through it. What did you see?
Well, I did see there was a lot of glass on the ground, but not where the door was. And I seen a lot of leaves. Like, they're like bushes of leaves in the back.
They kind of closed it up, and they didn't board it up.
This is Judy Cross, Nadia's grandma. I went over to her house a few days after book club to get the full story on Hubert Elementary. The school closed in 2005 because of low enrollment. DPS tried to secure it with big wooden boards over the windows and doors, but yeah, it didn't really do much.
Kids started going in there. They set it on fire a couple times, and we would have to call all the time. They were breaking out the windows and stuff like that. They left a lot of stuff in there.
You mean DPS left a lot of stuff in there?
Like what? Like desks and books and, you know, a lot of materials and stuff.
Judy lives with her daughter and her grandkids in a wooden bungalow, a house style that was popular back in the day for the area's working class residents. When I walk up the driveway, first person I see is Nadia. She's playing in the snow by herself, making snow angels. The big, abandoned elementary school across the street is a constant presence. Her grandma, Judy, is eager to tell me how different things used to be when her own girls were growing up here.
When my girls went to school there, there was all kinds of kids that lived here. They had lots of friends. They would always be out here playing. We had big birthday parties. My husband used to take the grill over there and grill for them for field day.
Now that the school across the street is closed, she drives her grandkids out to school in the suburbs.
Now, with them going to a school in the suburbs, they have no friends right here. There's no kids. So it's a big difference from when my girls were younger.
Judy loved her time at the school across the street. She was a teacher's aide for a few years, then worked in the cafeteria. She says some of the teachers even used to use her front porch for smoke breaks. But enrollment had dropped down to 350 kids from a high of around 500. Plus, test scores weren't great, so the district closed Hubert in 2005.
It bothered me because, like I said, I thought it was a good school. And that's one of the reasons we moved right here where we did, was because of the school being there.
You mean back in the 80s?
Yeah.
What would be the best case scenario for you?
For them to put another school there. I think the neighborhood needs a school.
When a school closes, property values go down, crime often goes up, and families move out. Everything looks empty. Drive through Brightmoor, you will see exactly what I mean. And the death of the neighborhood school is by no means unique to Brightmoor. Remember, nearly 200 DPS schools around the city have closed since 2000. So, how did we get to this point?
How did we get here? Oh, my. It seems like a really storied and complex circuitous route, but it's actually really very simple.
We'll get to her answer in a minute, I promise. But first, some context. Chastity Pratt-Dossi is a reporter for Bridge Magazine. But back in 2001, when the closures were ramping up, Dossi was an education reporter for the Detroit Free Press and had a front row seat to what was going on in the district.
Oh, it was crazy because, you know, the first year that it really hit home that this is going to be big and probably not good was 2005. You had 30 school closures, and you also had the Archdiocese closing 17 schools that year. That was just like a watershed moment. And, you know, just being in the trenches as a reporter thinking, wow, this is going to get bad.
It was like rapid fire the way the district was closing schools, and students and families left in droves. By 2006, the district was losing 10,000 students a year.
2005, 6, 7, 8, these were like hot and just crazy times for the school district. And I remember it was almost a story a day. And again, I don't think any of us, reporters, parents, school folks, would have thought that all of that would lead us to a place where there's only 48,000 kids in Detroit public schools.
48,000 kids in Detroit public schools. That's a 71% decline since 2000 alone. More kids in Detroit now go to charter schools than traditional public schools. So back to our question. How did we get here?
The state of Michigan, in professing to want to improve Detroit's schools, essentially destabilized the system through a succession of policy changes and reform efforts, essentially being school choice.
Ah, yes, the elephant in the room, school choice. Let's talk about it. The state passed two laws in the 1990s that were supposed to give parents more options for where to send their kids to school. Under the new laws, parents could now send their kids to schools outside of their district, and charters were allowed to open up with very little oversight. On the surface, these two things might not seem like a big deal, but in reality, they completely changed the academic landscape in Detroit. Test scores in the district weren't great when all this was happening. They weren't the worst either, but still. Detroit parents were fed up, they wanted better for their kids, and now they had choices. So they start to pull their kids out of DPS and put them in charters or leave the district entirely. Each time a kid leaves, their state funding goes with them. So now DPS is losing millions and millions of dollars a year. State funding remains flat. And then Detroit voters go and pass $1.5 billion construction bond to fix the schools. Here is where things take a turn. Chastity Pratt-Dossie says the school board kind of sits on the money for a while, doesn't spend it. And that is when Republican Governor John Engler steps in.
Engler says, you know what? The test scores are down, which they really weren't that much. And you haven't spent this $1 billion. We're going to remove your school board, put in a reform board that's appointed, and we're going to fix this school district.
That was in 1999. And up until this month, the state has been in charge of Detroit public schools pretty much ever since, save for a few years. That was supposed to make things better, but here's what happened. DPS continues to lose students by the thousands. The district pours millions of dollars into building and fixing schools, only to have those schools close or sold to charters a few years later. DPS schools continue to close while more charters open up. Test scores plummet to the worst in the nation. And by 2015, the district's deficit is at a whopping $515 million.
It was like the perfect confluence of craziness. For years, I would sit and listen to the teachers marching and the parents complaining, and they're all saying, our school district is being dismantled. And I sat there and I said, yeah, but that's not the problem. When you have something that doesn't work, like Massachusetts had, you need to dismantle it. They dismantled their school system.
When Massachusetts kids were struggling, the state put in a slew of reforms, including more money for low-income schools, tougher standards for all kids, and strict oversight for charters.
Here in Michigan, when you dismantle it and you put it back together in a way where it doesn't work, now you've destabilized it. You know, if something doesn't work, I expect you to take it apart, inspect it, and make it better. We didn't make it better here.
Most parents in Detroit would argue the state takeover and all the reforms made it worse. John Wilson lives in the Brightmoor neighborhood, where all the schools are either closed or very low performing. But she is one of the lucky ones. She has a car. So every week, she drives her four kids to a mix of public, private, and charter schools in and around Detroit to try to get her kids the best education she can. At one point, she was driving 160 miles a week.
You know, I shouldn't have to drive 160 miles to try to get my kids a good education. I shouldn't.
Meanwhile, the educational landscape continues to shift. Schools open, schools close, leadership changes, promises are made and not kept. So her kids have to move schools.
My children have been to 27 schools.
When she actually sits down to count the schools, the number isn't 27. It's 22. But still, I'm going to list them off so you can really understand the scope of what we're talking about here. Detroit Leadership Academy, Ralph Bunch, Noble Elementary Middle, Cornerstone, Mission City, Detroit Innovation
David
Academy,
David Ellis Academy,
Westside Christian Academy,
Allen Academy,
McKinney Day Treatment Center,
Langston Hughes Academy,
Loyola High School,
Henry Ford Academy,
University Yes Academy,
Eden Special Education Center,
Shrine,
Oak Park High School,
Detroit Leadership Academy Middle
Einstein
School,
Einstein Elementary,
and two other schools in Southfield whose names she can't remember and are now closed. 22 schools. How many schools did you go to growing up? There's choice in Detroit, but if your kids have to change schools 22 times because they're not getting what they need, is that good choice? There are more than 100 low-performing schools across the state. Sometimes we close those schools, and sometimes we try to turn them around.
Being a chronically low-performing school is not a life sentence. Schools can improve. However, that improvement is extremely fragile.
We'll look at what the research says about failing schools and what is best for students. That's in 10 minutes. This is We Live Here, a State of Opportunity special about neighborhood schools on Michigan Radio. Welcome back. If you're just joining us, this is We Live Here, a State of Opportunity documentary on Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer Guerra. We have spent a lot of time this hour talking about neighborhoods and schools and how the fates of the two are often intertwined, especially in high poverty areas. So how do we make sense of what is happening, not just in Detroit, but in cities all across the country? Why do America's inner city schools continue to struggle? To find out, let's go back to Noble Elementary Middle School on Detroit's west side and ask some of the students there what they think.
My name is Jaden Williams. I'm 12 years old, and I'm in seventh grade.
My name is Darnell, and I'm in seventh grade, and I'm 12.
Darnell's been at Noble since second grade, Jaden since preschool. We set up shop in the gym on a Tuesday morning to talk about their school and how things have changed over the years. Like many schools in high-poverty areas, Noble's had a lot of staff turnover. Darnell and Jaden have cycled through three different principals, Mr. Ellis, Miss Broden, and Miss Webb Harris. So I asked Jaden.
Do you even notice if you have a new principal?
Yes, because things start running differently and new things come in, new things happen and stuff like that.
Like, they got different rules, different minds and all that. And
this is Darnell.
They want to have their school how they want it run and stuff.
Once when Mr. Ellis was here, our gym floor used to be like dark brown, and all the wax been pulled off. And then since Miss Broden came, she had fixed that with new fresh wax. She painted it all over and then got us some more rims in the gym. And then when Miss Webb Harris came, she had hired a new gym coach, and the gym coach had sprayed our logo on the walls.
I love that gym metaphor. It is spot on. High poverty, low performing schools see this kind of churn every couple of years. A new principal comes in, puts their own systems in place, and the kids have to learn a completely new set of rules and expectations. The gym goes through it too. That's not stability. And this is not breaking news. Kids need stability in order to thrive. They also need a safe place to live. Here's Jaden.
Your neighborhood is very good. You go have a nice school. And for us, you see, we got all these burnt down houses. We got all these thugs and other stuff. People racing up and down the street.
He says all that stuff makes it hard to learn. There are so many negative things competing for their attention. The kind of neighborhood Jaden is describing disproportionately affects poor Black and brown kids across the country. And people expect schools to be able to overcome generations of poverty and racism and teach at the same time. It's a heavy, heavy lift.
We've completely overlooked the ways in which poverty affects learning and why it is that so many of the schools serving poor children are struggling.
Pedro Noguera is an expert on urban education, and he teaches at UCLA's Graduate School of Education. He spent a lot of time researching the role of poverty in schools, and he shared some of his thoughts with us via Skype.
We're one of few countries that consistently spends less money to educate poor children than we do to educate affluent children. And that means that the teachers in schools serving poor kids are frequently required or expected to take on roles that go beyond traditional teaching. They're functioning as social workers and counselors and therapists. And this, I think, contributes to high attrition amongst teachers in these schools, stress amongst those teachers, and school failure.
Noguera says if we continue to ignore poverty, we will continue to leave millions of children behind.
And again, we have to keep in mind, if we can change the conditions, we can change the outcomes. Because poverty is not a learning disability. There's absolutely no evidence that poor kids can't learn, that they can't achieve under the right conditions.
Things like small class sizes, highly trained teachers, social, emotional, and behavioral supports, stable housing, and access to high-quality early education. That's the ideal scenario. The reality on the ground looks a lot different. Take class size at Noble, for example. Here's the principal, Latoya Webb Harris.
My kindergartners each have 31 students. My first graders have two classrooms, and they both have about 32 students. Second grade is also very large, with about 30-plus students. So then you have K through 2, which is also our age group that struggle the most academically, and those are my largest classroom sizes.
And so I just want to be clear. So you just have a teacher per each class?
Yes.
The teacher doesn't have a parapro or a teacher assistant?
No, they don't.
Big class sizes are incredibly common in high-poverty urban schools like Noble. White, wealthier districts have smaller class sizes on average and more staff to help. Webb Harris does have two school service assistants who spend an hour a day in each K through second grade class. She had money in the budget for two more of those SSA positions.
However, that salary of a SSA is horrible, ridiculous, and what we ask of them is unfair. So until those salary adjustments are made, it is going to be very difficult to attract good staff members to do the work that's needed in priority schools. HR could not find anyone to fill the positions, unfortunately.
She also couldn't fill three full-time teaching positions, in part because she says the pay isn't competitive. Detroit also has the worst student chronic absenteeism rate in the country. Webb Harris says until that is dealt with, you're not going to see any real improvement in student achievement. Can't teach kids if they're not at school. So that's the bad news. But the school got a huge influx of cash from the U.S. Department of Education called School Improvement Grants, or SIG. President Barack Obama's administration doled out $7 billion in SIG money to try to turn around more than 1,800 schools across the country. Noble got the maximum amount any school could get, $6 million spread out over 3 years. In exchange, the school underwent a major turnaround 3 years ago, new principal, new staff, and a lot of investments in things like iPad carts, after-school activities for students and parents, and a data coach to keep track of student achievement. It seems to be working.
Over the past 3 years, we have gone up. It's been small increases, but they're increases. We need to make larger impacts, which is our goal, because our, you know, the increases have been so small. But when you start at 0% proficient, and now you may have 2% or 3% proficient, it's a small number, but it is, you know, climbing.
Being a chronically low-performing school is not a life sentence. Schools can improve. However, that improvement is extremely fragile.
This is Kirsten LaFlock. She's with the American Institutes of Research and has studied school turnaround effects for a decade, and SIG specifically. LaFlock traveled across the country to study some of the schools that got the federal grants. She found that more often than not, the grant served as a kind of catalyst for the staff. It helped to refocus the school. But the SIG money goes away after 3 years. And therein lies the problem.
A lot of schools were not really well positioned to sustain some of the building blocks that they had put in place under SIG. And that's really one of the saddest parts, I think, of SIG, is that sustainability, even in schools that appeared to be on the right track, so to speak, it was going to be hard to stay on that track.
When I talked to LaFlock in December, she told me a new study was coming out in January that would definitively say whether the SIG grants helped boost student achievement. Well, I just got my hands on a copy of the report. So, did those $7 billion help improve student achievement? The answer is no, it didn't work. The U.S. government spent billions nationwide trying to turn around failing schools, and I'm quoting here, overall, across all grades, we found that implementing any SIG-funded model had no significant impacts on math or reading test scores, high school graduation, or college enrollment. We started this hour talking about school closures and how they impact neighborhoods. People don't want their schools to close. Closures are personal and political. But does it help kids?
Hello.
James Kemple set out to answer that question. He is a researcher at New York University. New York closed its fair share of schools, including 29 chronically failing high schools. Rather than shut them down all at once, the district phased out the schools, not letting new students enroll after a certain point. And here's what Kemple found. The phase-out had no impact, positive or negative, on the students already at the school. But on the students who would have gone to one of those closed schools, it had a big positive impact.
We found that the students who had to pick other options did end up in better schools in terms of things like graduation rates, attendance rates, and test scores.
He says students at their new high schools did better, but not great. Graduation rates for those students were still far below the citywide average. A study in Chicago found something similar. Chicago closed a bunch of failing schools all at once, and the study found that the majority of displaced kids moved on to better schools. Again, better schools, but not great schools. And that is the catch. Only the kids who went to significantly better schools improved academically, according to the data. The latest study out of Chicago shows that only 1 in 5 kids was able to snag a seat in one of those top-tier schools. Another study out of Michigan also saw some improvement for displaced students who went to better schools, but it also found that kids at those better schools did a little worse with the influx of new students. One more thing, and this is specific to Detroit. Every time Detroit closes one of its schools, the district loses money and students. One district official told me when they close a school, they lose, on average, 30% of their students. They move on to charters or leave the city altogether. One-third of the kids leave. So, where do we go from here? It's a good question, and it seems like this woman will have a big say in what happens next.
Good morning. My name is Natasha Baker, and I'm the state school reform officer.
Baker grew up in poverty in California. She now lives in Detroit and is in charge of figuring out what to do with the state's lowest performing schools and all the students who go there.
So in the entire state of Michigan, there are about 100,000 kids in priority schools right now. And this is across 76 different districts.
Baker says she can appreciate the passion and emotion people have for their schools, but she says she knows the only way she was able to climb out of poverty is because she had a good education. That's what made the difference. There are currently 186 priority schools in Michigan, schools like Noble that are in the bottom 5% and trying to turn things around. The vast majority of these schools serve poor Black and brown kids who live in poor neighborhoods. Natasha Baker knows that life all too well.
This is something that, I've prayed about for a very long time as a child, that, if I made it out, that I would serve my entire life, spend my entire life helping other children get out so that they too can return. It's the only way to change the world. And so I'm excited about it. I understand the poverty conditions. I've lived that life. I have family members still living that life. But my goal is to make sure that every kid, especially those born in poverty, have access to quality schools. And that's what the work is about.
Baker's office just came out with a list of the worst schools in the state, schools that continuously fail to show student improvements. 38 schools are on the list and are slated for possible closure. By law, Baker is allowed to close those schools, but a Republican state lawmaker wants to repeal that law, so it's unclear at this point whether those closures will actually happen. Noble Elementary Middle School is safe, for now. It's got one more year to bring up those test scores. And what if they don't? We now know closing a school and shipping kids off to another school doesn't automatically improve outcomes for those kids. And school turnaround by itself doesn't seem to work either. Latoya Webb-Harris, Noble's principal, points out that poverty doesn't just go away because you change the staff or close a school.
Because then you have the same conditions, the same learning obstacles, the same challenges that then go to that school.
The thing all of these failing schools have in common is poverty. The vast majority of kids in the lowest performing schools in the state are poor. We are essentially asking schools to solve poverty. And if that's what we want them to do, we know what tools to give those schools. It's not a mystery. Other places have done it. But here in Michigan, we are not doing those things. And until we decide to change that, we will continue to fail our kids. Detroit, in particular, is teetering on the edge of what many believe and hope to be a real renaissance for the city. But
the city itself is progressing. So there's only a matter of time until the school system also has to progress, because the city will not be able to still do what they want to do if they don't have schools for the new and upcoming Detroit families to send their children to. So what they decide to do with those low-achieving or community schools, I guess it's, we will have to wait and see.
You have been listening to We Live Here, a special State of Opportunity documentary on Michigan Radio. A very special thank you to producer April Van Buren for pulling everything together this hour. She also produced an interactive map of all the schools at risk of closure in Detroit. You will definitely want to check it out. A big thanks to C. Doan for his work on the maps, too. You can find the maps, audio for this story, and all the other stories we've done for State of Opportunity on stateofopportunity.michiganradio.org. Thanks also to John Grover and the folks over at Loveland Technologies for all their research on Detroit Public Schools. The State of Opportunity team is Dustin Dwyer, April Van Buren, and Paulette Parker. Vincent Duffy edited the show with help from Sarah Hewlett. Zoe Clark is the executive producer of State of Opportunity. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Jennifer Guerra.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.